Perfect. Thank you so much for doing this. Thanks. Bye. Hi.
Chewbacca?
Hi, Chewbacca.
Hi. Hi, how you doing?
How are you?
I'm all right, yeah.
Yeah. I'm
trying to get together a playlist of British jazz.
You're doing what?
Yeah, going on.
What?
I'm trying to write this playlist that I agreed to do.
So what are you doing this set list for?
I'm doing a playlist.
A playlist?
Yeah. Someone asked me to do a playlist. I think it's for maybe Apple Music. But it's kind of funny that it takes you having to go through your collection maybe to just realize how much like diverse stuff is in. Despite the span of jazz in Britain, like going back to like the 50s.
Wow. Well, that's a good thing to do, isn't it?
Yeah.
And hopefully to get the word out there. I remember, you know, way back in 2013 when you were at Berlin, and I was just blown away by the Sons of Kemet, and I was pretty excited by it. Because for me, it was something really new and really, I don't know, just kind of like revolutionary to my ears. And I asked you at the end of the conversation, so when are you going to bring this revolution to the U.S.? And this is 2013. And you said, well, quote, it's notoriously hard for British groups to get to the U.S., unquote. And I went, oh yeah, I can understand that. But you've kind of like made the charge and kind of conquered the U.S., haven't you?
It's been quite surreal, you know, because it's that attitude of looking at the obstacles. It never goes away. Like there's a constant battle of getting visas, trying to get maybe the funding to allow us to come over. And it's like getting easier because actually that first step to take the plane in the States is the first step.
Yeah.
Increasing the visibility of the music, so then everything else becomes an administrative procedure. You know, and it feels like as soon as the word gets out in the States, like as soon as, you know, I've gone over with the first band, it made it a lot easier to just keep on coming over. Those things were made.
Yeah, it's really interesting. This year at the Winterfest, I mean, you played three times, which is pretty remarkable. People don't get a chance to do that. What was your experience at the Winterfest this year? I saw the Comet is coming, but I didn't see any of the other shows.
Yeah, it was great. I mean, the thing that I enjoyed actually being able to just maybe give people a taste of my life on the other side of the world, Uh-huh. And my life is trying to fit into these different musical situations and different like sensibilities among the musicians, trying to fit, like kind of fit myself into these different scenarios, but like every day, a different one. And it's like a constant negotiation in my life of how to interact with people, how to like, you know, get my point across without being, you know, without being pushy or being too dominant and all of these micro considerations. And I guess if you come to America and you only play in one band, people don't see that side of me. So this was good in that it was literally, this is my life, just running around.
It just seems like you have an incredible source of energy to be able to do this and to be able to with each of the bands that you have right now, the three bands, they're also brilliant in the way they're different and the way they're expressed by you, and not just kind of like throwing things off, but what incredibly well thought through and well conceived, I guess.
Yeah, it's interesting when you talk about the energy it needs to actually put out this much music or try to adapt these many situations. Because this is like something that I thought about around the time of the second Sons of Kemet album. This is the reason why I called it Lest We Forget. Because I was thinking about my grandmother's generation being recent immigrants from the Caribbean, from Barbados to England, and the amount of work or like the sense of purpose in actually going to somewhere, you know, going across the world and working, you know, in a situation that is openly hostile. So I think one of the things that I was trying to really reconnect with around that period was the fact that the reason I am here and living in this part of the world under and having the privilege to do what I do is because of the, you know, the sacrifices of that generation. And you know, they had to actually pull together to get up each day and work as hard as they had to support their family in England and back home.
Yeah.
So sometimes I'm like running from gig to gig, concentrating together, trying to like keep myself afloat. And I think this is nothing really in comparison to, you know, the power faced by that generation.
I mean, sure.
That gives me more energy.
Are you still there?
Yeah, I'm
good. Oh, okay, good. Sorry, I just moved something on my table and I thought maybe I disconnected you. I'm on a speakerphone, by the way. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you, yeah. It's a little bit distant, but I can still hear you.
Okay, I'll get up closer to the speakerphone because I've got a couple tapes taping this too. I hope that's okay. Yeah.
Yeah, fine.
Yeah. Tell me about how the Impulse deal came about. I was thrilled when I heard that. I just went, oh my God, this is so great. And not only the Sons of Kemet, which is the new album coming out, but also that you're booked solid with them right across the board, right?
Yes.
It's
quite an amazing occurrence.
How did that happen?
I mean, how it came about. Well, I mean, when I was in New York about a year ago in January, with the ancestors at Winter Jazz Festival,
yeah,
I met someone who told me, you know, you need to meet this woman, Dahlia. And I said, yeah, great. You know, so I met her, and she introduced herself, and she probably said who she was, kind of a writer, but it was after a gig. And sometimes in the rush of hearing, you know, meeting lots of people, having to talk a lot, you don't really kind of miss what they can tell you.
Yeah.
So she told me, you know, her name, and she said, you know, do you want to meet tomorrow? But I didn't know, like, that she was actually working with the label. But there's something about her that kind of said, you know, I ought to meet this woman because she seems like, you know, she does have something to, you know, discuss with me. But
yeah.
I met her the next day not realizing that the meeting was going to be her proposing, you know, the relationship between herself and Impulse to me. And we just got, you know, we talked for about a couple of hours before he even mentioned, you know, the Impulse thing. So it felt like my first connection to the label was on a really, you know, down-to-earth, you know, level. It wasn't me this, you know, contractual situation. It was really getting to talk about music, talk about the things that are happening in London, what I want to do as an individual. And then it came to the part that she mentioned, you know, there has been interest in my work on that, you know, on that side of things.
Yeah. And what was her...
What
was her name? Dahlia?
Dahlia, yeah.
What's her last name?
I have to check my email. I can email you, but all anyone on our base.
Okay, cool.
I don't want to kind of get it wrong.
Yeah, I could probably do some research on my end, but I just was, and she was kind of like an A&R person for Impulse.
Yeah, and she's still the person that we kind of go and, you know, one of the people on the team really kind of, that we're working closely to get the actual album, you know, out there.
Wow, that's pretty amazing. Well, I think just you know, again,
yeah,
from my
Catherine.
What's that?
I'm back, Kaplan.
Yeah. Huh?
Yeah. So, yeah, her last name's I'm back, Kaplan.
How do you spell that?
Double barrel name.
How do you spell that?
A-M-D-A-C-H.
Uh-huh.
And then there's a little hyphen,
yeah.
And then C-A-P-L-I-N.
C-A-P-L-I-N. Okay, cool. Yeah, well, you know, like the fact that she went to see you guys. I was at that show at the Winterfest, and it was just, you know, I by that time I had already been a fan, and I just thoroughly enjoyed it. I brought another friend who thoroughly enjoyed it, and but I'd had the experience that I had had in Berlin was so it was like right then I knew, wow, this is amazing music, and I hope someone, you know, takes the opportunity to, you know, bring you beyond the world of Britain and beyond Europe even. You know, I guess the Europeans knew who you guys were, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I can imagine... Huh?
No.
Yeah, so I can imagine when Dahlia heard you, she probably just went, oh my God, we have to have a conversation.
Yeah, I feel like what she was saying is that they've been having meetings amongst, you know, the team at the label, firing off different names of people, you know, of interest to check out. And my name came up from a few different, you know, areas. So then they decide, you know, and they really decided to check it out. And it really seems like that's the attitude of the label. Like, they really do know my work. And they really, the people that I'm dealing with are actually passionate about the music.
Yeah.
I guess that's what makes the label, you know, what it is to people, you know, which is why it's, a seminal label, because you can feel the joy of actually creating that product throughout the, you know.
Yeah.
You know, I guess just the discography of the label.
Yeah. Let me ask you a few questions. I really want to focus on the new Sons album, because this is going to appear in Downbeat in May, which comes out in April, which is when Your Queen is a Reptile is officially launched, right? So I want to focus on that, but I just want to pull back a little bit, because I did see the show, and talk about The Comet Is Coming, which was just a really wild, loud, grooving, kind of fun set that you guys did at the Winter Jazz Fest, and how that. Apparently, from what I've done a little bit of reading about it, is you just saw, you went to see Soccer 69, and then one night you went to see them, and you brought your saxophone, and you just got up on stage with them. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, I was a fan of the band. You know?
Uh-huh.
I heard them for the first time, and I remember thinking, whoa, these guys, intensity-wise, are giving so much. You know, I couldn't believe it, so I went to see them a couple of times. And then at one point, I had my facts, so, you know, and I knew them, I'd say hi, and, you know,
yeah.
Like, after the big previous gig, so they knew. I said, you know, do you mind if I sit in? yeah, fine. So I joined them, and it's like this extra pool of energy, you know, it just wasn't a problem. It just played really naturally together and created an atmosphere that was, you know, more than we'd experienced, you know, individually.
And that turned in, and then soon after that, after you played a little bit, you guys went into the studio, right?
Yeah. So the idea was just to go into a studio and improvise for 3 days, tape recording, and that's what we did. We, you know, all of the albums, Time of the Spirits and Prophecy, are small bits that are cut out of really long improvisation.
Uh-huh.
You know, so we'd be basically improvising tunes that sounded like they were composed, you know, tunes that had a regular pop structure, but they would just, you know, be rechanging chords, like something like Journey to the Asteroid Belt, or Neon Baby, which is on Time of the Spirits.
Uh-huh.
We just improvised it, and we just changed and needed to change, and then Dan took a long time producing the album and actually getting the sound stage right and deciding exactly how to edit the tunes, you know, in I guess a way, you know, coming up to tradition of albums like Bridges Brew and Silo.
Sure. I've seen some things again, referring to what you guys are doing is like what Sun Ra did back in the day, you know, going to some cosmic world.
I mean, I think there's that mutual want to not self-identify, or to have the process of self-identification coming from the point of the artist outwards, not have people project.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's the big inspiration that Sun Ra has given to me, the fact that you can create a mythology around yourself.
Yeah.
You can create that whole structure and you can live by it. Your music can be influenced and take on a world of its own through it.
Yeah.
And that's what we're trying to aspire to in the comments coming.
And what are you doing with your sax there? What kind of effects do you have? Because it, again, the sound is very, I guess, edgy, kind of gritty. And I saw that you had a little box to your left when you were playing. Do you run it through effects?
I went through one effect, a memory man, and yeah, it's the only effect I've ever used. It's pretty simple, but yeah, it's like this. It just gives a very basic delay. You can affect the delay, you can affect the level of feedback. I just like the soundscape of it. I feel like I'm not an effects guy.
Yeah.
And I don't experiment a lot with effects, but the effects that I do have, I really try to go into them and make it a part of my instrument.
Yeah. And what is it called again?
A memory man.
A memory man?
Yeah.
Wow, cool. Yeah, well, it was quite a journey. I'm gonna swing the subject over to your Queen is a Reptile, and I remember last summer at North Sea Jazz Festival I'd seen you guys a couple times, the Ancestors, and I believe it was Sia Bonga who kept singing, "We need to feminize our politics," in one of the songs. I can't remember which one it was, and repeating it over and over and over again. That certainly comes way out in the mix here on Your Queen is a Reptile, yeah?
The thinking behind "We Need to Feminize Our Politics" is the thinking.
Pardon?
You know, it's the reasoning behind why I tried to, you know, tackle these issues.
Yeah.
You know, the fact that we need to actually consider the feminine space, you know, who we're seeing as our feminine leaders, you know, really articulating who the people that we draw inspiration to our history, you know, are from a feminine perspective and a feminist perspective. You know, so I actually started the thinking behind your Queen is a Reptile from considering who are my queens. So each track is dedicated to one of the people who I would consider to be inspirational or has really significantly contributed something, you know, in the way I perceive history, because I think everyone has the queens that are particular to them and how they view, you know,
sure.
and the course of history. So it started from that, and then it got on to looking at, you know, the person that is our appointed queen in terms of what our state says our queen should be. And thinking about what Sun Ra said in an interview that I remember listening to a while ago, he said communities or people who are oppressed lose the power to create their own mythological structures.
Mm-hmm.
Their myths are handed to them, or their ways of viewing the hyperreal life are given to them normally by the oppressor. So I start thinking about what are the myths in our society that dominate our thinking so that we don't even think of them as myths. And for me, in Britain, one of the biggest myths is the myth of hereditary greatness. You know, the myth that's up because someone is born into a certain bloodline or from a certain
land, yeah.
That they automatically need more privilege than someone else.
Yeah.
So my thinking is, because this is a myth, when is the point at which me, as a second-generation migrant, get the power to actually disregard this myth and replace it by a myth of my own? Because for me, that myth is ridiculous.
Yeah.
It's no more ridiculous than... And me saying the queen is a reptile is no more ridiculous than someone saying the queen demands more respect than you because she's from a blue blood family.
Well, that's revolutionary speaking there. The queen is a reptile.
Yeah, so that's the kind of the world surrounding the album. And it's a strange one because it's not that I wrote the pieces. It's not one of these things that I say, oh, I wrote the pieces. It's very much considering, you know, the specific woman I'm talking about. But these are the thoughts and the ideas that were in my mind in the whole period of actually getting the album together.
There's a being an American and not a Brit. I don't really understand how the monarchy works in England. But you know, there's a Netflix series called I think it's called The Crown. Have you heard of that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Have you seen it?
I've not watched it. It's
well acted. It's really interesting historically. I have learned a lot from it. But the whole thing that kind of nags me all the way through is what a privileged life the royal family lives. I mean, the royal family is like huge, and I can't believe that British citizens are willing to pay tax dollars to support it.
Yeah.
And it's kind of almost, you know, ridiculous in a lot of ways. Although here in the United States, primarily we pay our taxes to build bigger and better nuclear weapons and to support our president going, you know, on vacation down to his house. At any rate, but I thought that was really fascinating that your queen is a reptile. So, for example, like a song like My Queen is Mamie Phipps Clark. Were you thinking of her when you wrote that?
So I was thinking about the general women that I have found to be inspirational around the time of writing.
Uh-huh.
And once we recorded all the tunes,
yeah,
I listened to them all and tried to think about which one of the, you know, like even if it's just an imagined connection between what tunes really resonate with me.
Uh-huh.
In the spirit of one of the women that I, you know, admire.
Uh-huh.
So once we finished recording it, then it's like the feeling of the tune rebounds with, you know, the feeling I get from reading the, you know, the story of these women.
Yeah.
You know, and it's a purely subjective thing. It's just, I try to act from intuition, but it's not so that I write the tunes and I know that the tunes will suggest an atmosphere for me.
Yeah.
You know, in the way that reading and thinking about the women's stories suggests a mood, maybe of resilience, maybe a mood of hope, maybe a mood of, you know, I was kind of going with, you know, I'm not going to put up the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, it's all about an atmosphere. For me, that's one of the points of the music as well, you know, to kind of broaden the palette of atmospheres that you can listen.
Hmm. The particular tune that jumps out to me is "My Queen is the Nanny of the Maroons." Are you playing? You're playing clarinet on that, right? Is that the only tune that you play clarinet on?
No, it's tenor.
It's tenor. Wow.
Yeah, it's still tenor.
Do you play any clarinet on this?
Yes. No, there's no clarinet on this album.
So there's no clarinet on this album. Pardon me?
No, not at all.
Yeah, it's all tenor. Wow. Well, yeah. Tell me about that, because that's kind of like it's like a somber celebration of I looked up all the people. I looked up all the women that who are in the song titles, and it was just a history lesson for me, because a lot of these people, you know, I knew who Harriet Tubman was and Angela Davis, but everybody else was just a real, you know, eye-opener for me. But how does that tune, how does that fit with Nanny of the Maroons?
Well, the groove that we're doing in that tune is a Maya Bingie groove. You know, it's the kind of foundation group of Rastafari celebrations.
Uh-huh.
You know, and one of my big inspirations in music is the group Mystic Revelation of Rastafari. He started as a Rastafari Naya Bingi group, so they'll sit around and play this rhythm for hours and hours and chant, and it's a religious celebration.
Uh-huh.
And this particular tune came after My Queen is Angela Davis, in that we recorded that tune. And as the tune stopped, the band kind of faded downwards.
Yeah.
I think someone, maybe Tom, just started a Maya Bingie groove and he, you know, spontaneously went into this other tune. So that whole song, Your Queen is My Queen is Nanny of the Maroons, is improvised. And for me, that's at the heart of the Maya Bingie, of the Maya Bingie experience. It's that something happened where we just created this, you know, this tune.
And it's a Mayingi experience? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, so Maya Bingie is the name of the foundation rhythm that we're playing.
Uh-huh.
The heartbeat. And that rhythm is normally played in Rastafari ceremonies. So at the point that we had gotten to, you know, after having played My Queen is Angela Davis and just fading into this, groove.
Yeah.
It really felt like we were tapping into a level of connectivity that, you know, people often get when they do, you know, ceremonies, religious ceremonies like the Rastafari.
Yeah. Well, that this also kind of, you know, plays into the whole, you know, I guess she's the Nanny of the Maroons, a Jamaican national hero, right?
Yeah, I mean, the Maroons were the first slaves to actually escape slavery and disrupt a community, a free community up in the hills of the mountains of Jamaica.
Yeah.
And, you know, they managed to actually keep and regain their freedom all the way to, to the modern day. They never got recaptured.
Yeah.
A lot of those communities. And for me, it's that resilience, that spirit, you know, that really inspires me, the spirit of going, we're actually going to, like, live a life where we're constantly aware of the need to fight for freedom.
Yeah.
You know, there's nothing that can be taken for granted, but they can see that, you know, all around them, people are enslaved, but they have fought for the ability to be able to function independently of the system or of the status quo around them.
It's a great tune. I love that tune. Tell me about My Queen is Ada Eastman. I don't know who she is. I looked her up, and there's a lot of Ada Eastmans. Who is that?
Yeah, you won't find her. Ada Eastman is my great-grandmother.
Oh, really?
I moved to Barbados at 6.
Yeah?
And she was alive for the whole time. She died at 103.
Wow, 103.
When I moved back to England, maybe 5 years afterwards.
Really? And she stayed in Barbados?
She stayed in Barbados. I think she worked up until, she was 60. And then, whereas a lot of people would retire, then went to America and worked another job for the next 20 years. So she came back to the Barbados, owning 3 houses, and really being the matriarch. The whole family relationship, she really, she was the person that held the family together. Everything gravitated around her. And I just remember, as a boy going to Barbados, seeing her maybe in her mid-80s on the roof, fixing her house and not allowing herself to actually, let time say what she should or shouldn't be. When you look at the vocals on that track, what poet Joshua Edahang is saying, he's talking about still here, he's talking about the resilience of immigrants to being in a system or being in a forest, foreign land.
It's cool. It's great. You also use Congo Natty on a couple tunes, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, why did you decide to bring him into the mix?
So Congo Natty is one of these people that I've just had a musical relationship for years, but it's not been documented on record.
Uh-huh.
And it's not been, it's not been enough gigs for me to say that I'm in the band for quite a while. If I'm around, really, I'd come playing jungle shows, do a couple of solos or play behind, the group. And it's been a real eye-opener in that progression of Afro-Caribbean music meeting the kind of electronic music of Britain, so that whole sound system culture.
Uh-huh.
The thing of people getting a rave and dancing, that is influenced by Caribbean music, is taking into a whole other direction. They're keeping that sense of energy and keeping that relentlessness going, I'm bringing in the dub aspects of, kind of Rastafari spirituality. This was all a scene and a way of operating that I discovered through working on the night. When we were recording this from the Kemet album, I thought I really want to take a symbol or a signifier of that whole ethos from that, place in British music history. And I want to see what happens when you take the voice, the attitude and the atmosphere of Congo Natty, in our rhythm of music. So it's taking two different strands of, diasporic African Afro-Caribbean music, seeing what happens when you place them together.
Yeah. What's interesting on the album, you have the poetry on the first tune, and then Congo Natty in the second tune. It's kind of an interesting way of starting the album out. And then you go into Harriet Tubman, and from then on in through the rest of the album until the end, it's all instrumental music.
Until the very end, and then
yeah.
Poetry comes back.
Yeah. Donnie and Lawrence.
Yeah. A lot of time thinking about the form of an album, and it's something I've tried to do in all the in all the albums that I've been a part of. Really think about how the album feels to the listener journeying from one point to another. Because for me it is a journey. You press play on the first track, and you go to the end as if it's a gig.
Yeah.
So it's a different attitude than recording individual tunes and then just. Randomly finding it's really thinking about how do you want to move the listener from one soundscape to another throughout the course of an album as opposed to a track.
Well, tell me about Donnie Lawrence. She's still alive. I think in 2014, the BBC said she's the most powerful woman in Britain. She seems to...
So Doreen Lawrence is the... She's the mother of the deceased Stephen Lawrence. And he was killed in a racist incident.
Yeah.
In the 80s. I can't remember exactly what year it was. But if it wasn't, you know, if the actual incident wasn't bad enough, there was a big police corrupt situation, which meant that the case wasn't, you know, being handled properly.
Yeah.
On an institutional level, and it was the racism of the police that was stopping, progress, you know, from happening with bringing the murderers to trial. And she fought tirelessly for the next, you know, 20 years to get the culture changed, not just to get her, you know, the murderers of her children, you know, treated properly in the eyes of justice, but actually to get a systemic change within the police service.
Yeah.
Yeah, and she achieved that by actually handling herself with dignity and with a sense of purpose.
And she's still active now, right?
She is, yeah.
Yeah. It's amazing. Tell me about Congo Natty being on that tune. About the whole idea of I want to take my country forward and talking about,
This is Joshua Lederhen, not Congo Natty on that one.
Who is that? Oh, it's Joshua. Yeah. Okay, cool. And.
But yeah, for me, what Joshua was talking about in that tune, the main idea of it is the idea of the riot. You know, so what he's going to be talking about, the London riots that happened a few years ago, and the fact that the situation that caused the community to riot were all a part of the same structure that would have led to Stephen Lawrence's killing. It's the ostracism of, you know, the ostracizing of certain areas of society. You know, the hopelessness felt by certain, you know, certain groups of people, and what happened, you know, to those people when, you know, when they need events, when they need to express, you know, the stuff that makes them feel like they do have some kind of say in society, some kind of agency.
Uh-huh.
The last line that you're talking about, I'm sorry.
What's the last line?
Yeah, the last line that he says in June, who raised the ship and leaves the loot behind.
Yeah.
He's talking about the fact that within the rioting, you know, situation, it's not about the stealing of the clothes per se, or it's not about the damaging of the infrastructure. It's about the, you know, the fact that these communities have had, you know, a history with their interaction with the state, which means that they've caused, you know, caused these kind of neuroses that these accidents happen. So in some ways, the human is calling for an institutional change to the fact that these riots exist.
Mm-hmm.
In the way that, you know, Doreen Lawrence doesn't just see her child as being murdered by racists, or that the police are being individually bad. She sees the need for an institutional change, you know, to battle then the secondary cause, you know, secondary
effects. Yeah. Well, it's something that continues to happen here in the United States.
Yeah.
When you were choosing these women as the song titles, were you aware of all these women, or did you kind of like go on exploration. It's like really fascinating. There are 9 women who most people will probably not know who they are.
Yeah, I mean, I went on the exploration, you know, mainly because, I started to think, you know, if I'm going to be thinking about the validity of the monarchy, who would I say my queen?
Yeah.
You know, and that's just like taking us as different. I know that a sense of, you know, different sorts of data has to occur, but, you know, if you take that as a given, you know, who would I say my queen is? And then I realized I don't actually have a big knowledge of women throughout these communities that I would say, you know, inspire me, that I can call, you know, all at will. So I just decided to really think back, you know, at what women, you know, have done really important things. then the first thing I did was I put a post on Facebook, and I said, you know, who can tell me who are the women that have really, you know, that they think have made a real difference in terms of
inspiration,
in terms of making a change. And I got hundreds and hundreds of comments from people.
Really?
Different powerful influence for women. Yeah, yeah. Some, you know, like 400 or 500 comments.
Wow.
And I really tried to go through all of them, just reading stories briefly, seeing which ones resonated with me. And it's not, you know, like the name titles weren't supposed to be any kind of comprehensive or like hierarchical list. It's just the stories that have actually inspired and, you know, set something alight within me as an individual. So, you know, it's like for everyone else to find out who their queens are.
That's amazing. Wow. So you got a lot of response for that, huh?
Yeah.
That's just,
there is there just seems to be a shift relatively recently of people considering, you know, the role, or like actually articulating the role that patriarchy is thinking in a patriarchal way.
Yeah.
In society. And you know, and patriarchy can be expressed just from the lack of its other. You know, just from the fact that we can't call, you know, 10 women that have been powerful, you know, so that is, you know, just, you know, on the rim.
Wow. Were you familiar with one of your queens is Albertina Sisulu? Is that right? From South Africa?
I've not really done a lot of research on how significant she was. So when I sent out that message, Sia Bowman from The Ancestors, the singer, he got back in touch with me and says, really significant to the story of her. She's one of the, you know, the real mothers of the nation, you know, of the nation.
Yeah.
Makes people feel like she's one of the people who really held the nation together within a dark, you know, in a dark time.
Yeah. It's amazing. Yeah, like I said, I've gone through all of them, and I only knew of a couple, each story is just, it's kind of like an untold story, I guess. Well, maybe not, to the general public, but I thought that was pretty poignant that you did that. Really great. Tell me, and this is probably a stupid question, but I love your saxophone playing. There's a melody to it. There's also kind of like it was certainly power. It's like power. It's rousing. It's rowdy. And I hate to ask you this question, but who are some of your heroes that either inspired you or pushed you toward that direction?
It all goes in phases, and what I find is that I listen to different people for different reasons. At various stages of my career. So for instance, at the moment, I'm listening to a lot of Charlie Parker.
Really?
But not for the same reasons, and not in the same way as I was listening to him when I was in college and actually trying to learn the stuff that he was playing. You know, I'm listening to Charlie Parker now as a drummer. You know, I'm listening to him as a rhythmic vessel of someone who is chanting rhythm and just communicating rhythmically in terms of his actions, in terms of what notes he decides to punch out, you know, in terms of what notes he decides to bunt, you know, to go. I'm just seeing him like sparring almost like a boxer, him in the bass drum or him in the bass in the snare, and that reaction. So for instance, I would say that Charlie Parker would be a big influence in, you know, how I'm trying to rhythmically spar between myself and the drummers and the light and the camera.
Yeah.
I've had periods of listening to a lot of John Coltrane. You know, and I mean, the thing with Coltrane is for me the strength. You know, so Coltrane can play, especially, you know, around the period of, say, Crescent, or like First Meditations. You know, you can hear that strength that comes with a complete, you know, like acceptance of one, you know, of one like, entire body. You know, and you know, acceptance of what, you know, where your mind is, you know, like you can, you know, it feels like, and this is maybe just me second guessing what I'm hearing, but it feels like you can really hear that Coltrane is at peace with, you know, at peace with himself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at individual. And, you know, like, I can, in periods of my life when I have been at peace with myself and my position in the world, and, you know, then I can really feel that connection. And, you know, maybe that one of the things that I'm trying, you know, it's a constant battle, you know, within life, you know, for me, is trying to actually retain that connectivity between yourself and your instrument and what you know is your purpose and sticking on the right path.
Mm-hmm.
You know, me, like, whenever I hear Coltrane, it feels like this is a man who actually has stuck to the path.
Yeah.
He's not let go. He's really connected to what,
mm-hmm.
to what life is, and then that translates to him connecting to what music is. And then, yeah, I mean, this, in terms of, like, on a technical level, you know, there's people like Eric Dolphy.
Yeah.
That, you know, I remember the first time hearing Eric Dolphy on bass clarinet, and just thinking, you know, I don't know how you can do what he's doing on any level, classical or jazz. It's actually the first time I've heard someone play an instrument that I just associated the classical music. And at that stage, I hadn't heard a lot of bass clarinet
mm-hmm.
in jazz. And I heard the album Last Date.
Yeah.
And just thought, you know, wow, like, he was blowing the idea of what I could do with the bass clarinet with that instrument.
Yeah.
You know, and not just what you could do, what you should do. You know, because this is, like, I guess the thing that I love about Eric Dolphy is that it feels like he chooses, he's got all the chops, he's got all the technical ability, you know, in the world, and he chooses to play in a certain way, like, to express his personality. Yeah. You
know? Well.
I could go on.
Yeah.
There's loads of different sectors, so.
No, that's. You know,
Yeah,
that's cool. That's cool. Thank you for reflecting on those people. I want to go back to your Queen is a Reptile again, and talk to me about your working relationship with your band. I know you got two drummers who you told me at one point, you know, they're not the rhythm section. They're doing something completely different. And then dealing with Oren, who's not playing a tuba in the, I guess, strictly New Orleans kind of style, but is doing something completely different. Tell me about your relationship with those guys. You guys seem like such an incredible band.
Yeah, well, it's a strange situation where we've changed personnel throughout the year slowly. But what happens with every change of personnel is that there's still an element of our actual interpersonal relationship that remains.
Uh-huh.
So the beginning of the band was, you know, myself, Tom Skinner, Seb Rochford, and Oren. And that just works as, you know, just as four individuals who have, you know, some commonalities, but, you know, who all have a very particular vision of music.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can feel that dynamic just between us. You know, there are four people that, you know, it can all, like, four strands traveling simultaneously, but not necessarily all hooking up at the same time. We felt like that was where all our perspectives were going in. But there was something that kept us together and actually propelled us into areas
mm-hmm.
you know, that we couldn't even, you know, perceive. So when Oren left the band about 3 years ago, his student Fionn Cross joined. And that really altered the dynamic in that Fionn's history is closer to mine because his parents were Saint Lucian.
So Oren left the band. Oren left the band when?
About 3 years ago.
Really? And who's the tuba?
Oren isn't on the second album.
Huh.
On the second album and this album is Fionn Cross.
Oh, the second album is what? Burn? No.
This is Fionn. No, the second album isn't Oren. The second album is Fionn Cross.
Huh. So the tuba player is, what's his name?
So Fionn, T-H,
mm-hmm.
E-O-N.
Uh-huh.
And then his last name is Cross.
C-R-O-S-S?
Yeah.
Wow. Interesting.
You know, Fionn's background, you know, brought the music closer to your real Caribbean underpinning.
Uh-huh.
You know, that was his, you know, the specific relationship that we have in terms of our share in the music that we grew up with. We can interact on a level that's, you know, that's scarily similar to, like, what we recognize as Caribbean phrases.
Gotcha.
Where we place that. Yeah. And then recently, the group has changed in that Seb now doesn't lead the band. Now we've got Eddie Hick.
Eddie Hick?
Yeah, Eddie.
Uh-huh.
E-D-I-E. And then Hick, H-I-C-K.
Uh-huh. So it's you, and it and is
Tom Skinner.
Tom Skinner still there?
Yeah, he's still there.
interesting. Well, I'd like to. Is there any way I can talk to those guys? Should I just talk to the people at Impulse to try to connect me up with your other bandmates?
If you get in touch with Rachel, do you have my manager's details?
What's her name, Rachel?
Yeah, she can actually put you in touch and organize be the person that you need to organize times.
So she's your manager?
Yeah.
What's her last name?
Rachel Miller.
Miller, okay. And do you have a contact for her?
Yeah, it's R-A-C-H.
Mm-hmm.
C-M-I-L-L.
So it's R-A-C-H, and then what's after that?
C.
C?
Yeah.
Okay.
C for contact.
Uh-huh.
M-I-L-L-A-R.
A-R, okay.
It's A-R. At gmail.com.
At what?
At gmail.com.
Oh, Gmail. Hey, can you hold on just one second? Somebody's ringing my doorbell, and I think they're delivering my coffee. Hold on. Thank you, I'm back.
Okay.
My niece sent me 2 pounds of coffee from California for my birthday. Yeah. So, what are you guys? Are you going to be coming to the U.S. again soon?
Supposed to be the end of June, yeah. The end of June.
What for? Just to play?
Yeah. We've got some different in Canada, and we're just organizing some in the States. Rachel has the details in terms of what the U.S. agency is, but I've not got the actual itinerary yet.
Okay. Good. And again, her name is... her email is R-A-C-H-C and Miller with an A, right? Perfect. Okay, I'll send her an email. And I also want to let you know that I'm a friend with Tim Jackson, who's the artistic director of the Monterey Jazz Festival. And do you know him? Have you heard of him?
I have heard of him, but
yeah.
I don't know.
I was at the Orvieto Jazz Festival in Italy over after Christmas and New Year's. And I said to him, you know, are you going to bring
Chewbacca Hutchings to Monterey. He goes, well, geez, I hadn't thought about it. I said, you really need to bring him there. He goes, yeah, I'd seen him up at Montreal and I was interested. So I sent him the press release that Impulse had put out. And so he said, hey, thanks a lot for this. So I don't know. It would be great to have you come out to Monterey. And in fact, when I was in Monterey last year, I did a live blindfold test with Tia Fuller. I played her Beware from the Burn album. And I'll tell you what she said. Hold on. Here's what she said. She did not guess you. She had never heard of you. I said, wow, that's intense. I thought I knew who it was, but then when the solo came, I didn't think so. I don't know who it is. I liked it, especially the precision of articulation. This guy's constantly pushing the edge with his sounds, his articulation, his harmonic ideas. The solo totally derailed me. This person's solo was very tonal. It felt like someone from New Orleans because of the groove and making the tuba such a strong element. So then I did it in front of an audience, and so I asked the audience, I said, does anybody know who this is? Nothing, silence. So I told them who you were, and she goes, Chewbacca, I've never heard of him. And so I said, I went out on the ledge and said, I guarantee you a year from now, you will know exactly who Chewbacca Hutchings is. That's how much I love your music, and I think you're a real important voice out there in the jazz world. There's too much jazz that is just not being heard, and it's not fresh, and it's the same old thing. And people are always in the U.S. at certain radio stations like, keep jazz alive. Well, I know how to keep jazz alive is play some adventurous music. And so I'm hoping that you have a great 2018. You really deserve it, and American jazz listeners really deserve to hear you. So there you go. And you'll open the floodgates for other British artists, like you're doing this playlist, right?
Yeah, that's what we're trying to do. Yeah. Really broaden the scene.
Yeah.
What people think about the scene.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, this is great. Chewbacca, thanks for taking the time. You're going to Brussels soon?
Yeah, I'm going to Brussels on Friday.
Yeah. The comm is coming, for sure. Okay, blow them away. I know you will.
All right.
Thanks very much.
All right, have a good day.
Take care.
Okay.